Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 10th of January. This hour of the program, James Grimaldi, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for the Washington Post. He's been at the newspaper since 2000 and has reported on national politics, Congress, business, legal affairs, and nonprofits. In 2006, he shared the Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting for helping to uncover the Jack Abramoff lobbying scandal. Those articles won a number of other awards as well. He and a couple other reporters from the Post have completed an interesting series on the NRA and how the gun lobby wields powerful influence over ATF U.S. politics. Obviously, the nature of our conversation will change a little bit, although not a whole lot, as a result of the horrendous killings over the weekend. The semi-automatic pistol that Jared Loughner used to kill six and injure 14 other people, including, of course, Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, was purchased legally, according to the Washington Post. Law enforcement sources told the newspaper that the weapon was legally purchased on November 30th at Sportsman's Warehouse in Tucson. The store manager said, "This stuff should never happen. We're cooperating with the ATF and all the federal agencies to help with this tragic incident." The source was unsure whether Loughner himself purchased the gun or if someone else did. A legal sale would involve the purchaser filling out paperwork and a background check to determine if the buyer is allowed to purchase a gun. A source with knowledge of the gun involved in Saturday's shooting said the weapon used was a Glock 19 9mm semi-automatic pistol. And it had a high-capacity magazine that can hold up to 30 or more rounds, 2 to 3 times a normal magazine capacity. We're going to talk about this gun and how somebody like this could be able to purchase such a gun. And, of course, the accessibility of guns, which I think must be a part of the discussion when you're looking at a horrendous event like what happened on Saturday. James is with us this hour. I can assure you we will have many phone calls, and let me give you our phone number. It's 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hi, James. Oh, no, James is on a special line. Hi, James.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
All right. Yeah. Good morning.
Good morning. You are loud and clear. So how does somebody like this guy go into a gun store if he did? We're not sure about that. Or if somebody else bought it for him and be able to get this kind of weapon, for heaven's sake. He's really got some mental issues. How could he get this kind of gun?
Well, he would have had to have been reported to authorities for him to be on the prohibited list. And there's a national instant background check that's done with every purchase. That's been required since 1994 with the passage of the Brady Bill. And he passed that background check because he essentially had never been legally committed by a judge. Now, after the Virginia Tech shootings, they did expand the number of people who ended up being placed on the list of prohibited people because of mental capacity. But in this case, he must not have gone through the right process that would land him on that list in order to make him a prohibited buyer.
Mm-hmm. And what about the kind of weapon, James, that he was able to purchase? This is one nasty weapon. Is this something that's available to everybody in the country?
Well, yeah, I'm sure you could go to Badger Gun Store in Milwaukee or wherever and get a very similar kind of firearm. I mean, we do have a Second Amendment in the country, and it's legal to purchase guns as long as you meet the requirements under federal law.
And what about the kinds of guns that you are able to purchase? Have you always been able to buy whatever the latest thing is? This is a weapon that can only be used to kill and to kill a lot of people. I understand it has been used by people in police departments, but what would be the reason for anybody wanting to get a gun with 30 or more rounds?
Well, I think you'll find, probably have even some callers today talk about about firing guns as a sports shooter or target shooting and that kind of thing. Also, guns, obviously handguns and other guns are used for self-defense. We did have a ban in the United States on assault weapons from 1994 to 2004, but when that law sunsetted, it was not renewed. The Obama administration discussed during the campaign its support for an assault weapons ban, but essentially has backed off any expansion of gun control laws since coming into office, with maybe one exception following our story about guns to Mexico.
And why was the ban on assault weapons lifted? Who lobbied that?
Well, the ban was in place because the law had a sunset of 10 years and would need to have been reinstated by a vote of Congress. It's interesting that was a very controversial law back in 94 when it passed, along with the Brady Bill. It was opposed strongly by the NRA and many members of Congress, and including, if I recall correctly, probably some from Wisconsin, voted in favor of it. And after that election in 94, you'll also recall that many rural Democrats who may have had previously good ratings with the NRA, including House Speaker at the time, Tom Foley, Foley voted for both laws, even though prior to that he'd had an A-plus rating with the NRA, and he lost his reelection, as did many members of the House, and the House went Republican under Newt Gingrich in the next January, 1995. Bill Clinton famously blames the loss of the House on the gun lobby, and in fact described the NRA as an unforgiving taskmaster. One strike and you're out, is what he wrote in his autobiography.
You say in your article, in one of the articles, that the NRA has for four decades been the strongest force shaping the nation's gun laws. So they're shaping the gun laws, not members of Congress.
Well, members of Congress obviously are the ones who write the laws, but the NRA and the gun lobby have a very powerful hand there. They in particular have a powerful hand both in a Republican Congress and a Democratic Congress. Essentially, you can't have a Democratic Congress without having rural Democrats, and many times those rural Democrats cannot be elected unless they have a good rating with the NRA. So the NRA, through its 4 million members, can be a very powerful force in American electoral politics, and they're also willing to put their money where their mouth is. And in the past two decades, we showed that they had spent well over $100 million in terms of political activity, lobbying, and campaign contributions.
Mm-hmm. What kind of soul searching, if any, do you think will take place in Congress and among Americans concerning the kinds of weapons that we ought to be able to purchase as a result of the horrors in Tucson?
I'm not sure there will be any limitations placed on the kinds of weapons purchased as a result of this. I don't think there is the political will or the political support to restrict certain kinds of guns beyond basically machine guns. And part of that has to do with the power of the NRA and also the support that many members of Congress have for gun rights.
And would you say that that's something that has grown over the history of this republic?
Well, I'd say there's a long history there. The NRA was founded after the Civil War as sort of an organization to sharpen the shooting ability of soldiers. It was probably not seen much until about the 30s when the first federal law regarding guns was passed, and the NRA actually was involved in testifying before Congress. I think they probably became a real modern political juggernaut in the 70s after the passage in the late 60s of the Gun Control Act of 1968, which was largely a response to the assassination of John F. Kennedy and Robert F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King. What you saw in that period was a movement for the hardliners within the NRA to sort of take charge of the organization. There was an attempted movement to go in a more moderate direction that really focused on hunting rights and maybe even move the organization out of Washington, D.C., out west. But the hardliners basically won over at what is known as the revolt at Cincinnati approximately the mid-70s. And since then, I think you've seen that the NRA has been a potent political force in American politics.
Extremely potent force. One of your articles, December 15th, talks about federal agents in charge of stopping gun trafficking to Mexico have, as you write, quietly advanced a plan to help stem the smuggling of high-powered AK-47s and AR-15s to the bloody drug war south of the border. Can you talk more about that? What kind of smuggling is going on here, and what were the proposed regulations?
Well, since about the past 4 or 5 years, when Mexican President Felipe Calderon basically launched this war against the drug cartels, there's been a dramatic increase in the number of weapons that have gone from the United States to the drug organizations in Mexico. In cooperation with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, the Mexican government has submitted thousands of guns to be traced to see where they came from. And the ATF has determined that well over 60,000 of those guns have come from the United States. Ooh. In a four-year period. Now, there's some controversy about what percentage of the guns they've seized have come from the United States, but clearly the actual number of guns, the 60,000 figure, is hard to debate because the ATF is really the world organization that's an expert in tracing these guns. Early in the Obama administration, the ATF had proposed putting a limit on assault weapons being sold by dealers along the border. And essentially, it would prevent the sale of multiple sales, or two or more within a five-year period, of weapons that had a caliber over 25, had a detachable magazine. Those weapons were to be limited in sale by those, or at least reported back to the ATF in that period of time. And the ATF would then be able to take a look at who's buying multiple AK-47s or AR-15s and ensure they're not being used as part of the drug wars in Mexico.
Right. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say that currently early in the administration, that kind of languished when it went over to the White House. And then after the election, and 4 days after our story about the trafficking to Mexico ran, the ATF submitted an emergency rule proposed to put this in place. And that's still pending with the Office of Management and Budget over at the White House.
It's still pending. So when will they act on it?
Well, it's a good question. You know, the ATF asked that they act on it by January 5th, and they haven't acted on it. Immediately upon our writing a story about this, and it was submitted and published in the Federal Register, which we found there was no press conference or press release from the ATF. Immediately after our publication of our story, the NRA rallied its supporters in Congress and has so far gotten about 38 members to write letters objecting to the proposed rule.
Hmm. You see, I don't understand that. My question is why? Why? What? Why would people be so beholden to the NRA? What's the point?
Well, these members, including the new Democrat elected in Alaska a few years back, Mark Begich, and the two Democratic senators from Montana, they believe that this could be a potential violation of the rights of people to buy these guns, people who want to have these guns. And the main objection is that the government should not be collecting any list of people who purchase weapons. They fear that creating a national gun registry would lead to a slippery slope where certain weapons could be banned, confiscated. And as the NRA spokesman said to me, the only reason you register a weapon is to tax it or to take it. And that's the general point of view of the members of Congress who oppose this rule.
And yet you have this other important piece of information, is that these guns are being purchased in huge numbers and they're being used to kill people.
Well, they're certainly being found south of the border.
Right.
In Mexico, no doubt about it.
Yeah. Let's welcome phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our guest is James Grimaldi, Pulitzer Prize winning investigative reporter for the Washington Post. They have done a series on the NRA wielding powerful influence over ATF and U.S. politics, and having done so for a long period of time. Our discussion changing perhaps just a little bit because we are all appalled by the actions that took place in Tucson, Arizona, and asking the question, in addition to all the other questions, about why Jared Loughner, who was obviously quite disturbed, and people had said at the school he was suspended from that he was disturbed, how he was able to get a semi-automatic pistol, a Glock 19 9mm semi-automatic pistol that had 30 rounds on it and was able to kill so many people and disturb so many people and disturb our democracy in Tucson over the weekend. So what kind of soul-searching do we do about guns, if any? This is the conversation this hour. Our lines are filled. But you'll be able to get through eventually. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Our number is 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. James Grimaldi is our guest. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And we go to Jason in La Crosse. Hello, Jason.
Hello. Hi.
Hi.
James, Kathleen, it's a pleasure. I just have probably three main concerns. And Kathleen, you said that I guess you were appalled at what happened. It just seems that we should be appalled, like, every day about all the lives that are taken on a daily basis, not just by guns, but by other means as well. And whether or not my concern is that there's going to be a vilification of guns in the NRA instead of putting responsibility on the powers that be that allow themselves to lose their integrity and to be bought and sold into, like money from the NRA or other areas like that, and also instead of highlighting the means that were to be taken to cause such a tragedy, but the reasons for such an action or intervention previous to, because, I mean, obviously guns are inanimate and they don't actionably kill people. People make those type of decisions, but how can we do that within our system and not to be derogatory in any way for the tragedy at hand? But there's so many people every day. Why aren't we highlighting this issue on a wide scale instead of just when it affects this small group of people? Thank you.
Well, this affects a large group of people. This affects our country, I think, considering what happened here. James.
Life of Guns was published prior to this tragedy.
Yes.
You can read it at WashingtonPost.com/guns. And as a matter of fact, when we embarked on the topic, some of us wondered, well, really, what was the relevance in the world today? Why are we doing guns now? And it just turned out that it ended up being a very timely topic.
Is he right? Do you think that it's an issue that we just don't pay enough attention to? Because there is a lot of violence in our society, and I'm not sure what his political perspective or point was on this, but a lot of people get killed by guns. A lot of people commit suicide by guns. It's an issue that's been a part of America for a long time.
Well, we didn't really study the or psychoanalyze the culture of America, but frankly, America is a gun culture.
Mm-hmm.
And what we looked at is sort of the laws and regulations and how that's regulated. I will say that over the years, when there have been changes in the laws regarding gun regulation, that has always typically happened after a major tragedy. And the Gun Control Act of 1968 passed after those assassinations that I mentioned, and as recently as after the Virginia Tech killings, there was some changes that expanded the background check to try to catch more of the people who were mentally unfit to own a weapon. So I'm not sure what will happen out of this one, but I suspect something will.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about President Obama's change on this? His campaign platform, you write, called for tougher gun laws, but now we're finding that the administration isn't saying much about this at all. The former ATF special agent in charge in Nashville, you're quoting as saying that Al Gore's losing his home state and the reason was the gun issue. Everybody knows that. Democrats know that. So why take up the gun issue or call for controls?
Well, one thing that's not widely known is that President Obama, when he was a candidate, had actually hired a former Washington Redskins by the name of a Redskin player by the name of Ray Shonkey, who went to a number of states and campaigned for Obama in rural areas, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Florida, some other places in the South. And that was paid for by the campaign. And his role, he told me, was to assure people that Obama's not going to take your guns. Mm. And so I think when he came into office, he intended really to tread lightly on that topic. And I think probably he had felt that he had a full plate with health care reform and other issues that he decided to tackle. I'm not sure that he's changed his position. In fact, I doubt that he's changed his position on these issues, but he's aware of the political reality, and that's that Congress would probably stop any effort to try to expand gun control in the United States.
And was there indeed an increase in the number of people buying weapons when he was elected because people were afraid he would take their guns?
Well, I don't know the motivation because we can't interview them all, but the best statistics are the national background check statistics, and those numbers did go up after he was elected.
Thanks, Jason, for your call. Let us go to Daryl from Couderay. Hi.
Good morning, Kathleen and your guest, and thank you for the program. I have a few comments. My first comment would be that people kill people. The gun could be a knife or a club. The tool is only a tool. I think there are people out there that feel they only have threats and now actions for what they see happening. In no way do I condone what this young man did, but I think he should have done what I think he should have done, and what every American that feels similarly should do, is go to your closest public flagpole and reverse the position of how that flag is flying. That is the only way I believe America will realize what has happened in this country. It's called a nonviolent action, not a deadly action. Gandhi was right when he said, an eye for an eye makes the whole world blind. Thank you.
James.
Well, it's interesting in this debate. You hear a lot of sayings, people, guns don't kill people, people kill people. There's sayings on both sides. Not taking a position one way or another about the sale of a semi-automatic pistol, I think it's fair to say that if Mr. Loeffner had arrived at the scene with a knife, that he would not have done as much damage.
Right. These kinds of weapons are, of course, meant to kill a lot of people, right? Otherwise, you would just have... It's not the kind of weapon you would use for hunting, is it?
No, not that I'm aware of, no.
Yeah. Thanks, Daryl, for the call. David in on the highway. Hi.
Yes, this is David.
Yeah, hi, David. Go ahead.
Yeah, my question is, why does anybody need more than one AR-15 or AK-47... And who's keeping track of the bullets that are being sold?
There's very little that's done in terms of regulation of ammunition. In terms of multiple purchases of AR-15s or AK-47s, that's why the ATF has proposed this emergency rule down by the border that would place a notification by the gun dealer to the ATF anytime two or more of the assault weapons, as they're described and defined in that proposed rule are purchased in a 5-day period. Now, you know, there are possibilities that someone could buy mini guns for Christmas presents. I've actually heard of that from ATF officials, and that will happen sometimes. There's a multiple sale requirement now for gun dealers. Anytime there's two or more guns in a 5 handguns purchased in a 5-day period, typically that's done to prevent handguns being circulated for the use in crimes. The reason that long guns, as they're called, are not part of that rule is that typically long guns, according to the NRA, are not used in crime.
How will the ATF be involved in investigating what happened in Tucson? Will they? And can you tell me more about what they do?
Yes, the ATF will be involved in tracing the weapon, finding out where the weapon was first purchased, analyzing the firearm to see if it had been automated in any way. But largely, I think the lead agency is the FBI. And I can tell you that the FBI and the ATF are two federal agencies now both within the Department of Justice that often can be at odds. I mean, they would tell you publicly that they cooperate greatly, but behind the scenes, there's been a lot of friction between these two agencies, particularly in the last few years, over who will be in charge of investigating explosive crimes involving explosives. And there was a recent opinion by the Deputy Attorney General that would rewrite the rules about what the ATF and the FBI would do. But I can tell you that both those agencies are still somewhat disputing exactly what that memo even means. The ATF really began, and you remember Elliot Ness, back in the Department of Treasury, and they were the agents that regulated prohibition back in the 30s. It was essentially a part of the Internal Revenue Service, and it was created formally in the 70s, separated from the IRS as an agency. And even in the 60s, the ATF largely went after moonshiners in the Southeast, but as crime grew in the 70s, it became more involved in helping cities try to curb urban crime.
Thanks for the call. Let us go to Kathy from Waupaca. Hi, Kathy.
Hello, and thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I've noticed on some chat boards that I go to, the discussion almost invariably devolves into, oh my God, nuts with guns. And it begins to paint any violent person as potentially mentally ill, or even worse, paints most mentally ill people as being violent. I think we ought to be asking the question, what exactly can motivate somebody to take a gun and kill a whole lot of people at once? And for the first caller who said, well, you can do that with any weapon. Well, it's a lot harder to kill a lot of people at once, say, with an ice pick or an axe. So naturally it becomes a question of why are we so in love with guns? And why is it such a, wonderful means of solving problems? That's just my comment. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy.
I don't really have a whole lot to add, I think, sort of response to that. But largely, we haven't had many limitations placed on the purchase of handguns in the country. When a person does buy any kind of a firearm, they have to fill out what's known as a 4473. And if you're buying a handgun, you have to be at least 21 years old. You need to be a legal citizen. You can't be an abuser of controlled substances or drugs, and you cannot be a felon and purchase a firearm.
Thanks, Kathy, for the call. And I read, I don't know if you had this statistic somewhere over the weekend, that there are 270 million guns in America?
That number's hard to know, but that's the number you often see.
That's a lot of guns.
Yeah, it's a lot of guns. Some, you know, get recycled, and some are, a lot of people collect guns. I've been to some gun stores where, you know, they collect guns that go back to the Revolutionary War. But yeah, we're a gun culture. There's no doubt about it.
Phil in Crystal Lake, Illinois. Hi.
Hi. My comment is about gun industry profits. Whenever there's a problem like this, the NRA likes to talk about the Second Amendment and our rights regarding guns. But I think it's good to point out that the motivation for the NRA is as a trade association for the gun industry, and they are interested in how much money they can make selling guns to Mexico or at gun shows or with a gun show loophole, etc. That's their main concern. They're not really concerned about our rights. And if they were, our rights to freedom and defending our liberty don't depend on having guns. In fact, having guns, I think, detracts from that right. So I would like to see more emphasis placed in a discussion program like this on gun industry profits, how they make their profits, and what they do with Congress to lobby for those profits.
James.
Well, the biggest lobbying organization is the NRA, even though the NRA will say that we represent gun owners, not the gun makers. However, many gun store owners and manufacturers are members of the NRA. The industry has its own trade association. The largest one is the National Shooting Sport Foundation, and they represent gun manufacturers and put on the largest manufacturers gun show in the world, probably, the SHOT Show, which is every January in Las Vegas. When you look at the lobbying reports, and my Pulitzer was for investigating the lobbying abuses of Jack Abramoff, there really aren't a lot of reports filed by manufacturers. There aren't the NSF files a report, but they just don't spend as much money as the NRA does. So they really are the big organization out there that represents the gun rights. I will point out that gun industry is not as big as, say, the tobacco industry. And when you look at the ownership of these stores, most gun stores, aside from like some of the big chains that will also sell guns, like Walmart and what have you, sporting goods stores, but most of your average gun stores are locally owned. They're often mom and pop operations on a relatively low margin. I can tell you that, having been to some of the stores in Texas, I think you're going to get a better margin often on the resale or the sale of AK-47s and AR-15s. I went into a store in Houston where their primary business is dealing in antique guns, but they had a rack right near the front door of AK-47s and AR-15s.
Oh, my. Can you go on the internet and buy a gun pretty easily?
Well, there are restrictions, pretty strong restrictions, about what you can do in terms of transporting guns across state lines and transporting guns in terms of through the mail and what have you. You're supposed to do that through a federal firearm licensee.
Thanks, Phil, for your call. Isaiah in Milwaukee, hello.
Hi. Well, I was listening to your program, and I enjoy it quite a bit. But one of the concerns that I have, mostly with the whole gun control idea, and I'll say right now, I'm a pretty liberal person, and I'm pretty I voted for Obama, and I like him, and gun control wasn't the issue when I voted for him. But one of the things that I'd like to point out that I feel that the whole gun control advocacy kind of misses a lot of times is the subject of where these people are getting these ideas to actually want to kill and hurt people. And I think a lot of times it jumps right on the should guns be banned, or are they wrong for people to own assault rifles? And they forget things like, well, the gun that this person used to hurt the previously that we're seeing in the news, I mean, it isn't even a assault rifle. This is a considered a self-defense type weapon. It's a handgun. And referencing some books that I've read on the subject, specifically by Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman, he wrote a book called On Killing, On Combat, and several other books. And what he points out is that a lot of this violent behavior is actually directly related and linked to violent media and violence on TV. And the problem I have with a lot of the gun control advocates is they kind of just drop that subject and go right to the, well, how are we going to stop this? And I kind of feel like just banning guns in alone, it doesn't really solve the problem. All it really addresses is the surface of the issue. What the issue is, we have people who actually want to go out and kill people. So I don't know. I would suggest reading those books before passing too much judgment on whether or not assault rifles and those type of weapons are really the culprit here. And I hope that sounds more of a educated response than guns don't kill people, people kill people. But I don't know. I'll leave it up to you guys.
All right. Thanks, Isaiah. Thanks for your call.
Well, that's really, again, out of my area of expertise, it sounds like more of a sociological response. But since Isaiah made a pitch for his author, I'd remind people you could read the series at WashingtonPost.com/guns.
He described this as a self-defense weapon that the guy bought. Is this a self-defense weapon?
Well, I think you would definitely find people who have purchased it for that very reason. You know, it's a handgun, and this one had an extended clip on it. I think there's a question about whether a weapon like that could fall under a definition of an assault weapon. But the problem with the definition, and this was the case in that law that we had from 94 to 2004, is that no matter how you define it, there are ways to kind of get around it. And in fact, there are many in the gun supporters who believe that assault weapon is sort of a is not even something you can really properly define.
Thanks for the call. We go to Mark in Madison. Hi.
Hi. I guess this is a subject that really frustrates me, and what really frustrates me is that you keep hearing over and over, like you said before, the comments, it's not guns that kill people, it's people that kill people. And getting the guns out of their hands, I mean, I think that people miss out and want to go to the sound bites and, oh, that makes logical sense, but they don't go look at the deeper part of it. And people don't look at the science of it. I mean, I don't know off the top of my head, but I have seen in the past articles about the amount of violent gun deaths in countries like in Europe that have very restricted guns in terms of, you know, almost essentially just for hunting. And you go to, I mean, when I was a kid, the last time I was in England, the cops don't even have guns. They didn't really need it on a regular basis because the guns are taken out of the society. And I don't know what are some of the statistics and numbers on violence with guns in countries in Europe, for example, that have very strict limits versus the U.S. And I think the science of it is right there. And people just, they spit up, they ignore the science for the cliche of it's not, you know, it's the person pulling the trigger. And it just drives me nuts that they don't look at the actual numbers and the statistics and what they say.
James.
Well, one of the things, frankly, we decided to avoid was getting into the myriad and hundreds of studies about you know, what can prevent gun violence or what have you. And instead, we focused on this particular law called the Tiahrt Amendment, which banned the release of gun traces. And media were using those to investigate where guns were coming from and looking just actually at the gun trafficking aspect. That's how we ended up into the Mexico story. And of course, you can't write about guns without talking a little bit about the power of the NRA. And it's sort of where we went when we were looking at this, and a little bit different, I think, than what your callers want to talk about. But we could talk a little bit about this guy Loeffner and how he got a gun. I think that there's no one who would agree. There's no one who would disagree. I think everyone agrees he should not have had a gun.
Right.
Okay, so even your Second Amendment supporters would probably agree with that. So the question is, how did he get it? What were the warning signs? What could have prevented it? You know, he had a drug arrest. So I think maybe because it was a misdemeanor drug arrest for paraphernalia, he did not end up on the list of prohibited buyers, even though drug abusers are not supposed to be able to purchase a weapon. So what happened there? We're actually doing a little bit of work looking into that question today at the Washington Post.
And also how somebody, I don't know what you do with this, but the information about his being suspended from school, that he was, people were worried about his behavior in the classroom. They were worried he was the kind of guy who would come with a gun to the classroom. I don't know if there's a way to get people help who are exhibiting that kind of behavior, but he, if he went in and bought the gun, he did it after he got suspended from school. Is there a way to keep people who need help from getting a gun?
Well, he actually had purchased a another gun a year ago in addition to the gun he bought November 30th. But, yeah, there's a question, you know, should people be reporting this? If someone is not fit to remain in community college because they're a little crazy, you know, what is the obligation of the administrator of that college to report that person to authorities? You know, he also tried to enlist in the military. We have an item on one of our blogs today that said that he was rejected. They couldn't give us the exact details about why, but it seemed to be related to either giving a false answer or not correct answer related to drugs or drug use. I don't know if that's because he didn't pass a year analysis or if they found his prior drug arrest. But the question would be, if he was unfit for duty in the United States Army because of a question related to drug use, then why should he be eligible to purchase a firearm?
Right. Let's welcome more phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our guest is James Grimaldi. He is a reporter, a member of the Washington Post Investigations Unit, has been at the newspaper since 2000 and has done reporting on national politics, Congress, business, legal affairs, and nonprofits, shared the Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting for helping to uncover the Jack Abramoff lobbying scandal. We are looking at the series that they did on the NRA, and of course, and that series was written, we may want to add, before the horrendous shootings in Tucson. So that is top of mind right now, and what we're thinking about and trying to figure out how somebody could get a gun who was in the condition that this 22-year-old was, but looking at the power of the NRA as well. Couple lines are open, 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go to more phone calls. Elizabeth from Green Bay, hi.
Hi. My question was about the cost of guns. I was wondering, the gun that was used in the Tucson shooting, about how much he would have to have paid for that one, that type of gun. And then also, you know, the higher up assault rifles, how much these guns are costing. And so that is my question.
Okay.
You know, I'm not a good expert on the cost of guns, but you can go online, not only for the store that he purchased it at, but stores in your local area about how much they cost. A lot of newspapers still run full-page ads. When we were down in Houston, we looked at a store called Carter's Country, which had two of the stores on the top 12 list that ended up having their guns found in Mexico. And every week, Carter's Country puts a full page or two pages of ads in the Houston Chronicle. So advertising is out there. You could look that up pretty easily.
Mm-hmm. And I have read it was $499 in a couple sources over the weekend. So thanks for the call. Let's go to Ed in Wautoma. Hi, Ed.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
So I was saying, rather than just concentrating on the negative or statistical aspects of guns or a negative rhetoric, ask everybody listening to the program to direct their positive key energy so that the congresswoman would have a full recovery. And it surely couldn't hurt to think that way. That's my comment.
Well, I'm sure that everybody is thinking that. Of course, people are.
Some of us are praying for her.
Yeah, exactly. Jeremy in Appleton, hi.
Hello. I guess my first question to you would be, I was wondering if you were a gun owner yourself.
No, I don't own a gun. It's against the law in the District of Columbia to own a gun, basically. I mean, the Heller case was recently overturned, but there are very few people who are permitted to have a firearm in the District of Columbia. And I think even after the Supreme Court decision, which overturned that law, they've issued very, very few permits for people to own a gun in the district.
All right. My second question would be, all these Olympic shooters in, let's say, skeet and target shooting, with all this going on, are we going to label them all assassins, assassin types, where they're able to shoot people at long distances, or are we just going to let them be able to do what they want in this free land that we call America.
Jeremy, you seem to be under the misimpression that I oppose gun ownership. I do not.
Let's go to an email. The prohibited list of gun customers does not apply to increasingly popular gun shows. That's a huge loophole increasingly used by gun buyers. I'm a gun owner, but I'm completely appalled by the actions of the NRA and the current status of completely inadequate gun laws. I've been asked numerous times to join the NRA, but I prefer not to belong to this organization. In addition to tragedy here, our NRA-written gun laws are supplying the weaponry used to kill over 30,000 citizens in Mexico.
Yeah, the so-called gun show loophole is interesting. Both sides of that argument are fascinating. Essentially, if you're a gun dealer but you're not a federal firearm licensee and you're selling at a gun show, you don't have to require the buyer to fill out a 4473, and therefore they don't go through an instant background check. Say you're a gun shop and you decide to go sell at the gun show, you do. So many of the real gun dealers who have gun stores also are a little uneasy about this. But the NRA would say, well, look, these are really dealers, people who own guns and trade guns with friends. There's no reason that they believe that there should be a law that would prevent you from inviting a couple friends over and saying, I'll trade you my gun for that gun, or I'll pay you the difference. And there's nothing in the laws of certain states, or certainly not the United States, that would prohibit that. So there's a debate about what you do with the gun shows. I can tell you, though, that some dealers are some of the best tipsters. When they see prohibited sales going on at these gun shows, they may actually call or tell the ATF, hey, I think that dealer over there who is in an FFL may be selling to someone who probably shouldn't have a gun or may even be a felon.
Mm. We go to Michael in Wausau. Hi. Michael, hi.
Hello. Yeah, I was just going to tell you that, like the Glock 17, the Glock 19, and the Glock 22, those are also officer issue weapons, and you got the 22, and that would be a 40 caliber and a 9mm. They're weapons that are produced for the military and police, and then also you can use them for self-defense. A lot of bow hunters, I know, where I live, take them in the woods with them because we've got wolves and cats. Well, they say there's no cats, but there are. And if you're in the woods after dark with a bow and one of these animals decides to take you as prey, you have no self-defense. So a weapon like that is carried for that particular purpose. Maybe not for hunting that animal, but for self-preservation against wolves or a cat that would decide to, pursue you, you know. So that weapon is a viable weapon outside of the crazies that get their hands on it. We shouldn't have to suffer for that, I guess.
Right. I've heard that obviously hunters might have a handgun with them, often do. And, you know, a lot of the purchasers of these weapons may even be police officers who want to have a second weapon in addition to their service revolver that may be paid for by the authorities. So the caller makes very good points.
One of the people that you spoke with said the NRA is clearly the most powerful lobby in the United States, that it has shaped gun policy and shaped the ATF. After your reporting on this series, do you think that that is true, and how have they exerted their influence?
Well, I think they definitely are one of the most powerful. There's no doubt about it. They exert their influence through stopping any laws or regulations that may put limits on gun ownership. And I think they put pressure on a lot of lawmakers. And if they're not happy with how they perform, they may be engaged in trying to have them lose their next election. I think the strength of the NRA comes out of its membership, and a lot of people follow their ratings. Even if they're not an active member, they may say, well, if the NRA is running an ad saying this particular lawmaker wants to ban guns, they may actually lose some votes in certain parts of the country, no doubt about it. And so I think that's probably the source of their power. And plus, they spend a lot of money. The NRA told me they spent $20 million in the last election, which is not all of it, even has to be reported, because that would include voter brochures and internet websites that would show voters who they support and who they endorse and who they back for both local, state, primarily state and federal offices.
Mm. James, thank you so much for being with us. We'll look forward to the reporting that you do from Tucson to find out more about the weapon there. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
James Grimaldi, he is a member of the Washington Post's Investigations Unit and collaborated in a series that the Post did before the Tucson shooting on the NRA gun lobby wielding powerful influence over the ATF and U.S. politics. He's been with the newspaper since 2000 and received the Pulitzer for helping to uncover the Jack Abramoff lobbying scandal. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for doing on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. Great conversations ahead on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.